Today is December 20th, 2018. It's Thursday. This is a Grand Canyon oral history phone interview with Edward Montgomery Jr., M-O-N-T-G-O-M-E-R-Y. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Ed. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, and I need to give you one correction. My father and my first name is Edwin, E-D-W-I-N.
Thank you, E-D-W-I-N, Edwin. Thank you so much. May we have your permission to record this interview over the phone?
Yes, you certainly may.
Thank you so much. Ed, what year were you born?
1937.
And where were you born?
In Tucson, Arizona.
What were your parents doing in Tucson back in 1937?
My dad was about to go into the Army. He was a graduate of the University of Arizona and was commissioned through ROTC at the U of A. And was about to go on active duty. He went into the Army as in the cavalry, but then the cavalry was soon dismissed, and so he went into the field artillery at that time. And when I was born, he was in Tucson, but and helping to teach school. I don't know whether he was teaching at the U of A, as he did sometimes, or at various high schools in the area. But in any event, he was about to go on active duty.
Okay. And he had graduated by that time, by 1937?
Yeah, he had 2 degrees from the U of A by that time. One in education and one in engineering.
Thank you. How did he get interested in aircraft?
I think he just always been fascinated by it, and he... During World War II, he actually worked as an aeronautical engineer, and he moved to the West Coast, and he worked for Douglas in Santa Monica, and then also for the Hughes aircraft during World War II, and that sort of helped to sharpen, hone his interest in aviation, and at the end of the war, he had decided to go back to his home state of Arizona and begin a small airline there. And the helicopter service that he got into, the small airline was never able to generate much, but a subsidiary to it he established called Arizona Helicopter Service, and that was begun. We started with one pilot, and Dad went back at Bell and also got checked out as a helicopter pilot. And I think at the time he was the first person to have a commercial license to operate helicopters without also having a commercial fixed wing ticket. He had a private license, but he was not a commercial fixed wing pilot.
Okay. What was the name of the aircraft company that your dad started?
Southern Arizona Airlines.
Okay.
And as I say, the sort of changed directions as that got started, and he thought he was really interested in helicopters. And as I say, the service he began was called Arizona Helicopter Service.
So when was your first helicopter flight?
I'm probably thinking 1948 sometime.
Okay, you would have been 11?
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay. And do you remember the name of the helicopter pilot that was working for your father?
Yes, his name was Chuck Marthens, M-A-R-T-H-E-N-S.
Thank you. What do you remember about Chuck?
As a kid, he was a very respected pilot, or at least my dad had a lot of respect for him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a nice guy. He was friendly to youngsters like I was. He did a lot of firsts flying the helicopter. He was the first person to fly a helicopter south of the Tropic of Cancer and north of the Arctic Circle, flying for Arizona Helicopter Service.
Did he fly that helicopter from Tucson all the way south and all the way north, or was it shipped overland in any way?
He flew the helicopter south. What Dad had gotten was a contract from the Mexican government to develop a railroad from Mazatlan on their west coast into Durango, which was in the interior. And as I recall, at that time, there wasn't even a road that made that trip.
Hmm.
But what they needed the helicopter for was to carry surveyors along that route. And yes, they did fly the helicopter down to that point. Then when they went to Alaska a few years later, I think that was 1949, but I'd have to check that out. It was again a contract with the government. They were mapping Alaska, and they went up to and operated out of Nome on the west coast of Alaska, happily in the summertime, as you might imagine. But that was when they went above the Arctic Circle.
Okay, all right. And then in 1946, the Southern Arizona Airlines, was that started in 45 or 46?
I think it was 46, but the video I gave you would have the exact date on it.
Okay, and then there was a flight to Salt Lake City in 1946. Can you talk about that?
The only thing I know is that they, again, Dad had a, he was looking for anything that the helicopter could do that where we could put some money on the table.
Mm-hmm.
Bringing Santa Claus into various places in Arizona was a popular thing that people wanted. The helicopters knew and created crowds wherever it went. But they got an interest from Salt Lake City to go up and fly Santa into Salt Lake City. Now, I think at that time, Dad was back getting his helicopter commercial license back in that may have been in Buffalo, but I'm not sure about that. But while he was gone, they took the helicopter up to and flew it up to Salt Lake City. Now, for going to Alaska, I think they did take it apart and fly it in an Air Force aircraft up there.
Hmm.
It was pretty small, and they could get the rotor blades off of it and put it inside an airplane. On the way back, Chuck and the mechanic we had flew it down to the northwest, and Dad went up in Dad and Mom together went up in a trailer that big enough to pick up the helicopter, and they picked it up and gave the pilot and his mechanic a well-deserved vacation.
Hmm.
And then they drove it back from the Pacific Northwest to Arizona.
Okay. There is some video that you've kindly shared with me. It looked like there were thousands and thousands of people on the street there in Salt Lake City in 1946. This was December when they came in and landed downtown.
And they landed right in the city, right in the street in the middle of the city. We did a lot of things that probably wouldn't happen today.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
As I say, the helicopter was brand new to everybody, and there people were very interested in seeing it.
And that was a Bell 47A, is that correct?
It was a 47. Now, as to whether it was an A or a C, I don't know. It was a little confusing because that original NC-2H had a bubble canopy, and we then replaced it with another Bell, which was a different, it looked more like a helicopter does today. And it was I think, called Bell 47B, which to me, as looking to and researching this, didn't seem to make any sense that it would have a designation looking newer than the one of the original aircraft we had. But that was a mystery I have not been able to solve.
Okay. I did spend some time too looking into the Bells. It looks like the A was the first one going, and then the B, the red one.
Yeah.
Was a B. And so on the way back from that flight to Salt Lake City, it looks like there was a flight into the west end of Grand Canyon.
Yes, they did. They went and looked at the canyon as they were flying over it and got some good pictures of the canyon. I don't know whether the idea had come at that time to my dad that he might go up there and operate. Possibly he had, but in any event, the helicopter didn't go take a look at the canyon.
Okay.
The western end of it.
So your first helicopter flight in 1948. What do you remember about that?
Actually, it may have been now that I think about it, it might have been as early as 1947.
Okay.
There in the video I sent you, there was a picture of my sister being taken to her school outside of Tucson. So she went to a Catholic girls' school. And did that have a date on it, by any chance?
It didn't, but it would have been in that 47, 48, 49 time period.
Somewhere in there, I got a ride in the helicopter. I got more rides in it, though, as when we went to the Grand Canyon in 1950.
Okay. And can you talk about your dad's work with the governor?
Well, he, with the governor of Arizona?
Yeah.
Well, he was able somehow to convince, and I don't know whether he convinced the governor or convinced the governor's media relations guy, to on the first day of our operation, to actually pick the governor up at his home. The helicopter went up and landed in the street outside his home, picked him up, and flew him to the Capitol. And later that day, they then flew several other people from their homes to the Capitol. And it was basically just to, as the first day of operation, to get some publicity for the company.
And that would have been in 1946 then?
Yes.
Nice. Okay. And then 47, 48, do you have any other interesting recollections of that 47, 48, 49 time before y'all moved up to the Grand Canyon?
A couple of them. One of the big things in Arizona at that time was a lost gold mine called the Lost Dutchman that was in the Superstition Mountains east of Phoenix there. And it was when I say popular, it was among people looking for gold. It was well known, and there were lots of stories about, and books written about the Lost Dutchman. And it had, the Dutchman who had found it protected its identity very carefully, as you might imagine, and it was lost. And a number of prospectors have gone in there before, and a number of them were killed. And that was added to the mystery of the mine. And a prospector came to Dad and said that he had found somehow a map to the Lost Dutchman, and he wanted to take a helicopter in because it was in pretty rough territory. And so we did. Dad took the gentleman in, and they dropped him off at one place, and then flew him around, and he said he got his bearings, and then they left him where he was making a base camp, and the idea is that he was going to make his way out himself, but then he didn't show. He disappeared, and the his family or business partners or whatever came to Dad and said, hey, he hasn't appeared, and so Dad actually went back and looked for him with Chuck Marthens. And they found the base camp, and with a few days of food and so forth gone from the base camp, and they could find nothing else. And interestingly enough, about a year later, the prospector's body was found well south of the Superstitions, and his head had been cut off.
Huh.
And that, of course, added to the lore of the mine.
Yeah. My gosh.
I'm trying to think. He also, they needed some, he helped make a couple of movies where the helicopters were first being used by the hero to go do whatever heroic things he had to do.
Oh, okay.
And we just were the bus drivers, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
In that. And I'm trying to think of the names of some of them, but I possibly couldn't come up with a name if I'm looking through his records.
Yeah, no worries. So can you speak to the uniqueness of the helicopter at the time?
Well, it was unique in the fact that it was the only piece of aviation, the only aviation vehicle that could go straight up and straight down, forward, backwards, and sideways. And that, of course, opened up its ability to do a number of different things. One of Dad's disappointments was that he had hoped to be able to get a contract from the government to carry mail into some of the mining communities in remote sections of Arizona that didn't get regular mail deliveries.
Okay.
But he was never able to get that done.
All right. Then there was a contract in 1948 to make a delivery deep into Grand Canyon.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
Can you talk about that?
Well, what had happened is the Episcopal Church in the Diocese of Arizona had been able to make contact with a small tribe of Indians called the Havasus, they had a small village at the bottom of a tributary canyon to the Grand Canyon called Supai, and had a village down there called Supai. And the church wanted to fly in a Quonset hut to be a mission church for these Indians. And Dad got the contract for that. And in the winter, was that the winter of 49? I'm trying to think. It may well
have been. So it would have been in the spring of 1948.
Then we made the delivery actually in better weather, but the trip for Dad to go in and talk to the elders of the community was cold. I remember it well because as a little boy I went with my dad, and we took a jeep up as far as we could, and then to descend into the canyon and get onto the village, we rode horseback.
Okay.
And so Dad went in and with some people from the church, and they talked to the elders of the tribe. And set up the delivery of the Quonset hut for later when the weather was better.
What do you remember about that horseback ride into Supai and about the village itself and the ride back out, besides being very cold?
It was cold. I was well, had a coat on and everything else. It was a slow ride. It was not something we galloped down and did. We were descending canyon walls and that kind of thing. But as it was... All I remember is that as a little boy, I did not get to go in with the dad and the elders when they were discussing things. And I stood outside and tried to talk to a little Indian boy, a little bit older than I was, but he didn't speak English, and of course I didn't speak Havasu. So.
Mm.
But that's how I spent my time while I was waiting for Dad to do his business.
Nice, and you would have been 11, of course. So.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. And then there was an accident or some sort of trouble with the Bell 47B there I guess it was March 48.
The spring was about with us, but the weather was still cold.
Okay.
Up in northern Arizona at that elevation, and our pilot Chuck Marthens had a hard forced landing because he didn't de-ice the engine, and the engine froze up.
Oh.
Carburetor ice. And so Dad had to, because we had a contract to deliver the church, Dad had to rent a helicopter from the West Coast to come out and do it.
Okay.
But it was also a Bell of a similar model.
And then fix the 47B back up.
Yes. The helicopter that had the forced landing, we had some minor repairs to it, but no, it flew again.
Okay.
It flew for the whole time the rest of the time that the company existed.
Okay. The helicopter rotor blades were made of wood at that time, is that correct?
I believe.
Okay. So this is a multiple flights into Supai that happened, I think, in April of 1948, over 20 flights to carry the parts of this Quonset hut.
I was not present for those.
Okay.
I just knew that it was going on.
Okay. Which was a great success, and that building still stands down there.
I believe so.
So in 49, then, what are your recollections about how your dad got in contact with William Randolph Hearst?
Well, Dad, in looking for ways to try to make the helicopter company profitable, decided that a great way for tourists to see the Grand Canyon would be in a helicopter. And especially it would be good if he might even be able to land at various places in the canyon, let people walk around and explore and that kind of thing. And he went up to talk to the Park Service at the canyon, and they said that they would not permit the operations to be there. I remember Dad at the talking to the gentleman who ran the canyon at that time. His name was Dr. Bryant. And Dr. Bryant, one of the reasons that Dr. Bryant gave was they were worried about noise, and that he was concerned that the noise of the helicopter would make the pregnant does in the park abort.
Huh.
And Dad, of course, thought that was a specious argument, and went looking around for other ways to do it. One of the things he had to do is to, because they wouldn't let him operate in the canyon, he had to find a place outside the canyon to operate, which he did. He found a small tourist thing. It was a bar, cafe, service station, and several cabins that for tourists, about a mile and a half, 2 miles south of the entrance, south entrance to the Grand Canyon. And he went and bought that. The guy was interested in selling, and Dad bought the site from him. And it had a down below the hill that this bar, cafe, and service station where it was on, there was a meadow where that was being used by a cattle ranch there. And Dad negotiated with the cattle ranch to let us go in and use the meadow for takeoffs and landings. Now, but he wanted to be able to land up there. He did some exploring, and he found out that there was, in fact, one piece of land right in the middle of the canyon, in the middle of the national park, that the national park had not bothered to buy up, and it was an asbestos mine. And it was right on just above the intergorge of the river itself, well down in the canyon, just maybe 100 feet above the river. And so he investigated and found out that people hadn't worked it for a long, long time, and probably wouldn't be working it. The Park Service figured it because it was almost impossible to get to it unless you were going there by helicopter or you took a boat in and hiked up. But that was probably not a very effective way to work a mine.
Mm-hmm.
But Dad found out that it was technically owned by William Randolph Hearst, and so he contacted Hearst and asked if he could lease the permission to land his helicopter on the property. And Hearst not only agreed, but was very interested in seeing how that operation worked. And as I recall, he leased it to Dad for operation for $1 a year.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Huh.
And we did go down and operate there at the bottom of the canyon.
What do you remember about flying down there?
Well, it was exciting. There was one time I made a trip down there. By this time, Chuck Marthens had left the company and gone to another helicopter service, and there was a fellow named Red Carson, who was our pilot there in at Grand Canyon, and he had a young son, and Red and one of the mechanic that we had, and I'm have a senior moment, I don't remember his name, flew this boy, I think his name was Jimmy, flew Jimmy and me down to the bottom of the canyon just to show us. They were sort of testing it, how well this whole thing could work out. And what we discovered is that if the winds were coming up over out of the south, over the top of the south rim, they would then blow down on there, and the helicopters of those days were not powerful enough to be able to get high enough to get out of the canyon.
Huh.
And we, in fact, had to spend the night down there.
Okay.
And I remember it because the Red Carson and the mechanic had to bury the wheels. They found a little pickaxe in the mine, and they actually buried the wheels of the helicopter so that it wouldn't blow over the cliff and into the water.
Oh, wow.
And I remember sleeping with Jimmy in a rock crevice, and we took turns sleeping on top of each other because if you were on the bottom of the crevice, it was uncomfortable, but you were warm. If you were on the top, you were comfortable, but cold.
But cold.
We swapped. I was 11 or so, maybe 12 by that time. Let's say 15. Maybe I was 13 by that time.
Mm.
And he was about 10 or so.
Okay.
And but the next day, Dad was able to come down in the Bell. We were in the Hiller that we had at that time, and Dad was able to come down in the Bell and see 9H, and we tried to get out and couldn't. And so we went down, had to fly down then, and we unloaded all the gas out, the remaining gas out of the Hiller into the Bell. did we load it into the Hiller? It was a lighter helicopter. I'm trying to remember now how we flew out. But Red then flew himself and the two of us. We were the lightest load possible out once we'd waited for the winds to subside.
Okay.
And then he got a full load of gas and went back down. And I think he was in the Hiller, as a matter of fact. And we went down and we were able to put enough gas in both of the helicopters to get out.
Okay, so it sounds like you guys were maybe right on the margin of weight.
Oh, the north edge of the canyon was, I think, above the service ceiling of the helicopters in those days.
Really? Okay.
And the south end was just below it, so this was a challenge.
Yeah, what can you it sounds like maybe in 1948. Your dad got involved with the Hiller Helicopter Company?
Yes, it was a new company building helicopters out on the West Coast. I remember going out with him on a trip he made because he was interested in buying the Hiller, if he could. And I remember I went up for a test flight in the Hiller. It had an engine failure, and we did what they call an auto-rotational landing, which is something familiar to any helicopter pilot. And you basically glide down and flare just as if you were in a parachute, and happily everything worked out. They did the auto rotation the way they should, and nothing was hurt in the helicopter.
So wait a minute. Let me make sure I understand this. You guys went to look at a Hiller.
Yes.
And its engine failed while you guys were testing it.
That's right.
Oh my gosh. What is an auto rotation like? Does I'm assuming it's fairly loud with the engine going, and suddenly the engine's going to stop. Does it get kind of quiet, or is there still a lot of noise from the auto rotating?
No, in this case, I believe in auto rotation, the engine has quit.
Okay.
And what you're doing, you are descending, but with enough speed to have the rotor blades turn.
Okay.
And it is still as it turns, it's still generating some lift. And it's as you come down closer to the ground, you then use all of the energy of the rotor blade to halt and make a safe landing. And then, of course, by that time the energy is gone, and you're going to touch the ground somewhere. It's just hope that there was enough energy left to make it a soft landing.
And that there's some space down there, you can land on something wide open, and yeah.
That's very true.
What?
You had to be concerned about that kind of thing. Obviously, in the canyon, there are places where you sure can't land, and so you always have to be on the look. I remember just as a young boy, nine or so, my dad was teaching me how to fly a light plane, and we would he'd have me flying along. I could fly hold a heading and an altitude, and he then suddenly at one point in time he would close the throttle and say, "Okay, where are you going to put the airplane?"
Wow.
And the lesson he was getting across is that you had to. That was had to be part of your mental calculus, especially when you were flying a single-engine aircraft,
okay,
helicopter or fixed wing. You had to have a backup plan in case there was an engine failure.
So, with an engine failure, would you lose the small rotor in the back on the tail there?
Not, I believe as long as the front rotor was turning, the back rotor did also.
Okay, so there was a little ability to.
There was a connection to it.
Great! What a wonderful was a wonderful idea. Whoever invented that.
Yeah.
So then you guys had a Bell and a Hiller. How
yes.
would you compare those two craft at that time?
Well, they were. I think they were fairly similar in capability. The Hiller, as I recall, was lighter, and it had a different sort of modern. Almost an open cockpit type of thing. It had a bubble, what you could do is in the video I showed you and in the pictures you have. There's one picture that you sent me that shows both helicopters in the meadow down below the bar and cafe and service station
mm-hmm.
called Tucson. And of course, today Tucson is a thriving village. And there are a couple of helicopter companies that operate out of there to go over the canyon.
Yeah. And I do want to go back to, and ask you about your recollections of Tucson at the time, back
Tucson.
in yeah back in 1949 and 50.
Sure.
The question though about the helicopters, did they both have doors?
Yes, they did.
Okay, so in the winter you
You could
could.
take them off, though, but
Oh,
they did.
okay.
They did
So,
have doors.
but in theory, in the winter you could put the doors on and turn the heater on. Some one I would assume to try
True.
to keep the cab sort of warm.
Yes, true.
Okay, all right. And the Hiller was lighter than the Bell. Okay.
I might meet, but you were interested, but one of the, because this was the first company, Dad did a few first things. He believes he was probably the first person to operate the helicopter at night. And he got a light put on the NC-9H, and they actually flew it at night, tested it, and got it approved by the FAA. And he went back to, he thought he was the first in that. He went back, and there's a monthly magazine about helicopters put out, and he went back to the magazine and gave the date of his first flight and asked if he had, if anybody else had been operating at night before then. And as I don't recall he ever got a reply to it, but there's a good chance he was the first person to fly them at night.
Okay.
He also, they had crop dusters that they had at work put on the helicopter, but I think they wanted to get a crop sprayer, and so he had one developed, and we were the first ones to actually spray crops from a helicopter.
Okay. And that would have been 48, 49 time?
Somewhere in there, yeah,
Okay.
or 47.
Okay. And what do you remember about, and it sounds like your dad bought a gas station and a little restaurant and a couple cabins. What do you remember about that?
Well, it was several cabins, but that's why we didn't rent those out. We lived in those. I had two sisters, and we, of course, we had my dad and mom and the helicopter company, and the mechanic, and the other pilot and his wife and child. And so that's what we lived in. We had to generate our own electricity, and we had two big diesel generators that we used. And I can remember one of my passage of manhood when I got big enough to be able to start the bigger of the two diesel engines. And so we'd shut them off at night, and then in the morning we'd start them up again and generate electricity. And water, we had no water, but in order to have running water for the restaurant and that kind of thing, and for us, Dad had to drive a tank truck down to Williams, which is, what, I don't know, 50-some miles south.
Yeah.
And every week and fill the tank with water and bring it back for us.
Okay.
And so it was a rough, interesting existence, certainly an exciting one for a kid. I ran the service station. In other words, I pumped the gas.
Okay.
And we had to lay our own telephone wire up, from us up to Grand Canyon because wasn't going to be done for us. So we went and laid our own telephone line. And it was the old-fashioned type where you had to go in and ring a handle on the side of the apparatus and alert the operator, and she would come on, and then she would place the call for you.
And connect you in to the party line.
It was a party line.
Yep,
yeah.
Yep. To place out your call. Nice. Was there a lot of traffic going up the road?
Oh, sure. It was the main road from Williams to.
Okay.
Approach the academy. You can only get to the Grand Canyon two ways: one from the south, and one from the east, to the south rim we're talking about.
Okay.
And this was the main road from off Route 66 up to the canyon, so it was well traveled.
How did your dad advertise the fact that there was a helicopter there to take tours?
Well, he took that big trailer that he could tow the helicopter in one at a time, and he put a big sign on the side of it that was easily seen as the people drove down. And I think he probably had other signs along the road, but we didn't have the money to do heavy advertising. He might have put an advertisement in that helicopter journal I was talking about, but I don't know that. I'm not sure that he did.
Okay. All right. And then what else do you remember about flights into the canyon?
Well, people could ride in, and get a good look at the canyon, or they could pay a little more and actually go down and land at that asbestos mine and walk around.
Okay.
And I would say that we were sort of marginally successful. The helicopters knew some people were interested in it. Other people were thinking, they were reluctant to fly in this operation.
Mm-hmm.
And but we, I think we were surviving, I'll put it that way.
Okay.
What the Park Service sort of reluctantly had to admit is that when they had people that were injured on the trail or injured in navigating the waters of the canyon, the only way you could get to it was by helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would go down on occasion and rescue people. We had one other interesting operation, and that was when the wife of the chief of the Havasu tribe was pregnant and started having complications in her pregnancy. And we actually took the helicopter, went in, and flew her out of Supai, the village at the bottom of that little tributary canyon, flew her out there back up to the, I wouldn't call it a hospital, but it was a clinic there at Grand Canyon Village. And Dr., I think his name was Leo Schnurr, was the a friend of ours and was able to successfully work with the wife of the chief, and both mother and child did well.
Nice. Very good. And that would have been 1950?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. All right. Yes, and so then Otis Marston and Ed Hudson, and it would have been mid-June, roughly, of 1950. They had arranged a photo shoot there at Hance Rapid with the Arizona Helicopter Service, and then went on downstream where Ed Hudson abandoned his boat. Margaret Marston then thought something was wrong. She was watching from the rim. She hired your father to help go look for them and found them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you guys, your father and Ed.
Red,
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Elmer, that's right.
His first name is Elmer, but you can understand why it went by Red.
Yes, sir. And so Red, then they flew in the Bell and the Hiller, and on the way out, the Hiller sounds like it had the same thing happen. What happened to you guys when you and your dad were testing the Hiller?
Well, Ben, what dad was flying, I think, the Sun out of the two that were down there, and Red Carson in the Hiller was flying. What was his first name?
His actual name was Egbert, but he didn't go by Egbert. He went by Ed.
Yeah, Ed. And was flying him out. And, yes, the engine failed, and Red made an auto-rotation landing to the best site he could find, but it destroyed the helicopter. So Dad had to go up what they did is they took a sleeping bag, they brought the son out, but they had to leave the father down there, Ed Egbert, and went back, and Dad then went back down the next day in the Bell and picked him up and brought him out.
Okay. So was this the, wasn't there another?
I'm losing you. Your volume is going down. Maybe I'm. Are you moving away from your mic at all?
I could be. I'll. Thank you. I'll speak louder. Wasn't there another crash with the Hiller in southern Arizona earlier?
No. There was the NC-2H had crashed very, very early in the operation. That's one reason we got the NC-9H.
Okay.
It was out doing survey work. I don't know if there's an oil company or what it was, but it failed and there it crashed. And,
oh, okay. So that was the Bell.
Yes, that was the early Bell.
Got it.
The 9-9H.
Okay.
And there was a second Hiller crash, though, that actually was right at the end of our operation in 1950 up at the canyon. In this case, the engine failed and they did a not successful auto rotation. Landed on a sandbar in the river, and the airplane was flyable once he went down and fixed it. But his dad took off the sandbar, it failed again, and this time it went into the water. And so that was the other problems were that Dad was having a great deal of trouble getting spare parts for our helicopters, because in 1950, the Korean War came along, and the helicopter had become, for the first time, an important part of the air effort in Korea.
Okay.
And we couldn't get parts because the military had priority. So he finally decided that, well, we'd given it a try, but it was important for him to go back and put bread on the table, and so he went back to work as an aeronautical engineer.
And then did you guys go ahead and sell out the Tucson operation?
Yes, we did.
Okay.
And moved back east. Dad got a job with Sikorsky Helicopters back on the East Coast, and we moved to east.
Okay.
Pennsylvania, near Philadelphia.
All right. Let's hang on a little bit more with 1950 here. In the fall, so people were taking rides in the helicopter, but maybe not as much as you might have liked. I mean, it was a very new thing, and you know, getting people into that was understandably difficult.
Well, what you just said is correct. It was not succeeding as much as we had hoped, but on the other hand, it was. I think the operation would have continued had we been able to get the parts needed to keep the airplanes flyable.
Okay, and then there was a crash in late October down near Phantom Ranch.
Okay, well that's the second one in the Hiller I was talking about.
Okay, and so so they went in and fixed that.
Yes, and but it wasn't a crash. That was a successful auto rotation.
Okay. Oh, all right. So the ship went down under engine failure, auto rotation.
Yeah, and then on a sandbar.
Okay.
But then they fixed it. They thought.
Okay.
When Dad took off to bring it back up out of the canyon, it failed again, and this time it crashed.
Okay.
He didn't have any. Again, he survived. He was able to do the auto rotation landing, but he didn't have a good landing place at all.
Got it. Yeah, sure. That's a difficult deal. So at this time, this would have been the fall of 1950. Were you going to school at the Grand Canyon School then?
Yes. The they had a school grades 1 through 8 there, and I was in the 8th grade.
Okay.
And then to go to high school at that time, you had to go down to Williams, south of Williams. That was the nearest high school.
Okay. What
but
do you?
I didn't do that. I went to 9th grade back in Pennsylvania after we moved.
Okay. What do you remember about what would have been, I guess, just that one fall that you were there of 1950 and going to school?
It was interesting. We had enough for a junior high baseball team, and we would actually go around. And of course, we had to go great distances to play somebody, but we did. We went to Williams and Flagstaff and Holbrook and Winslow.
Wow.
That's a long way.
That's a long ways.
I remember one night coming home with one of our teachers, our baseball coach, and we were in his pickup. We had been in several cars, but I happened to be in the one that he was driving the pickup. And as we were driving along the road at night, all of a sudden we saw this very, very large, at least it's sure large to me, mountain lion feeding at the side of the road.
Wow.
So our teacher stopped and everybody drove around armed at that time, and he reached back for his rifle that he always carried in his pickup, and because there was a bounty on the lions, and discovered he didn't have the rifle with him.
Oh.
So we watched there, and the lion looked up from what he was eating and gave us a dirty look and loped off into the desert. But that was my first and only time I saw a mountain lion up close.
Wow. Huh. So the roads back then were, I would assume that the road was paved from the canyon south to Williams.
Oh, sure. And, of course, Route 66 then went to the other places.
Right. Would have gone east to Flagstaff and on to Winslow and Holbrook. But that must have been just hours and hours and hours going at, you know, 50 miles an hour or whatever. I'm sure that it was a great rate of speed at the time, but...
It was a labor of love. We liked baseball.
Wow. Nice. What else do you remember about school there?
Well, in there were, like I say, grades 1 through 8, And in fact, there were four of us in the eighth grade, and we were in the same room with the second graders, and the same teacher taught both classes.
Okay.
And which was, I'm looking back on it, I'm sure it was a challenge for him, but it seemed to go well.
Yeah. Nice. What else do you remember about that year, 1950, that you want to make sure gets recorded in this interview?
Living there was quite an experience. I had a .22 rifle, and I went out and hunted rabbits, and my mom told me, you clean them, I'll cook them. And so we would have a rabbit stew every now and then.
Nice.
And but that was that kind of an environment. We were out away from a lot of things. We didn't have any close neighbors or anything like that.
Okay.
And it was sort of a rough situation. There was one time when there was one movie in town, and we would go into town to see. A movie. I don't know whether it was every weeknight or whatever it was, but occasionally the movie would come, and we would drive into Grand Canyon Village, which was about 7.5 miles away, as I recall, something like that, and go to the movie, and they had a case where a waiter had gone berserk and had shot and killed his girlfriend and up at the Grand Canyon Village, and
right.
Then had disappeared.
Right.
And they had called out to us to alert us because they thought he might try to work his way south and maybe steal a vehicle from us or something like that to
okay.
make his escape. And I remember there was a movie that night, and so my dad had me take my .22 rifle, and I had a clip of .22 ammo on it, and we went in and took my sisters to the movie. And I was not the only person there that was unarmed. I mean, was armed at that time. There
uh-huh.
were several people. That was sort of the thing at the time. Everybody knew how to shoot a weapon, and interestingly enough, we didn't have any cases of being used improperly in those days.
Uh-huh.
It was just part of your growing up was you knew how to use firearms.
Ed, where did your mother grow up?
She was a Hoosier. And
where? In Indiana?
Well, she was born in, I think, a town called Fairmont. And then the family moved to Gary right outside Chicago, right on the border between Illinois and Indiana.
Okay.
And my grandfather, Scott, ran a small printing company there. And I can tell you an interesting story about that.
Please.
The punchline of the whole story has to come to me.
Okay.
If it does, I'll remember it, write it down, and tell the story.
Okay.
But
you know, I'm
my grandfather Scott had an illness of some sort, and they thought he needed a dry climate.
Okay.
And so the family then moved to Arizona, and she began to study at the University of Arizona, where Dad was.
All right.
That's
and
where they met.
That's where they met, was on the U of A campus then.
Yes.
So the reason why I'm asking is because you've reminded me, living in the little Tusayan camp, miles from the village and like you say, 50 or 60 miles from the nearest little town of Williams, must have been terribly remote for both your parents who, were used, Tucson was a huge,
comparatively,
had movie theaters and had newspaper and civic things to do, a university. So did the remoteness play into, how did your parents handle the hardship, I guess is what it.
Frankly, they didn't run short of things to do.
Okay.
Mom ran the bar and service and restaurant, and Dad ran the helicopter service, and they were busy probably 26 hours a day, that type of thing.
All right.
And also trying to keep the thing, keep us in water, make sure the generators could generate electricity. And,
right.
And we had oil for them to run them and that kind of thing. And they certainly, I'm sure they missed the theater and musicals and that kind of thing, but
mm-hmm.
occupied in trying to make the business succeed. And I certainly don't remember ever feeling myself remote or bored or anything. I got up in the morning and went and opened up the service station. I pumped gas, and I was busy all day.
Yeah, I would think it would be a great adventure for you.
It's pretty hard on the parents. Though,
yeah,
obviously.
And of course, then in the winter, certainly then, not quite so much now, but visitation really dropped. I mean, there was snow on the roads, and so it clearly would have been a financial hardship with the loss of revenue just from the number of people coming into the park.
Very true. It dropped off in the wintertime.
Okay. All right. Just trying to put that together. So with the loss of the Hiller there in early November, in parts difficult to get, then it sounds like your dad made a decision to go ahead and move on, if you will.
Yeah.
What did he do after that?
Well, like I say, he worked for Sikorsky back on the East Coast. And he was a consulting engineer. He went where the work was.
Okay.
After we stayed in Grand Canyon for a while. And
Did you? Okay.
Until he find steady work.
Got it.
Because we were getting revenue in from the bar and cafe and service station.
Okay.
And there weren't all that many places that people could go and stop at it in those days.
Yeah.
And so they did. That reminds me. Let's see. I remember another story. I think I may have told you on the phone before, but this, I think it would work now. We had a big sign. We didn't put it up there. The previous owner put it up outside the restaurant as you approach the restaurant on the highway. It said, Toucan Cafe, not recommended by Duncan Hines. And
that's
one
right.
day, Duncan Hines himself showed up at the restaurant. And all Mom made really were hamburgers and chili.
Uh-huh.
And he ate those. He said, well, that's good enough. I'm willing to recommend you, but there was a fee for that, and that was not in the ballpark. But it was just interesting that Duncan Hines himself stopped by.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, it was.
Were there any other people like that came to the canyon that you remember?
I can't. I don't recall offhand. The tourists came. Of course, they all had stories and that kind
mm-hmm.
of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Something just came to my mind. In one of the pictures you showed me that showed the meadow with the two helicopters parked in the meadow, and going up the hill from that is where you see the bar, cafe, and service station. You can see the huge fireplace that would also form part of the wall to the bar. And you can actually see that in that picture that you showed me.
Okay.
And when my wife and I went back to northern Arizona a few years ago, I wanted to show her what had been Toucan and all that sort of thing. That is the only thing left of those buildings. But it was that fireplace, huge fireplace, was still standing, and it was in a city park in downtown Toucan Village, and people could go there and use it to grill their hamburgers and that kind of thing.
Nice.
But if you wanted to know what how the fireplace looked like and how big it was, you can get an idea by looking in the background of that picture that you sent me.
Okay. All right. Interesting. Yeah. That would be fun to match that up. Things to do. I'm sort of running out of questions here on my list of things to ask. Is there anything else you would like to bring in that I haven't asked you about?
Well, just some other things. The video shows this, but I think it was important to remember that after Dad had retired and he and Mom were living in Tucson again, the National Helicopter Organization had its annual get-together, and they picked Tucson that year. And so they were there, and while they were there, they honored Dad for having started the first helicopter company.
Nice.
And that, of course, helped make up for a lot of disappointments in his life, and we were all very proud of that. Arizona Aviation Hall of Film, Hall of Fame museum display at the Pima County Air Museum, just south of Davis-Monthan in Tucson.
Nice. Very nice. Excellent. And grandchildren, of course, I'm assuming, great-grandchildren.
And one great-grandchild and a second on the way.
Okay. All right.
I myself had four children, two boys, two girls, and I think we have eight grandchildren now and one great-grandchild.
Nice. Well, lots of fun. Great. Well, Ed Montgomery, this has been just a wonderful interview here. Thank you so very much for recalling the early days of Arizona Helicopter Service in the 1940s and into 1950 with your father, Edwin Montgomery. And today is December 20th, 2018. My name is Tom Martin, and this will conclude a Grand Canyon oral history. Thank you so much, Ed.
Okay. I won't hang up if you want.
Yeah.